Captain's Log, Day 173, The Search for a Natural Way to Kill Weeds.
Hey there, I'm Captain Jack, ecologist and gardener. Not long ago, I found a compound in goat milk so effective at killing weeds, it's the active ingredient in my Deadweed Brew. Captain Jack's Deadweed Brew kills weeds and grasses anywhere and everywhere, and it's approved for organic gardening.
Protect your oasis with Captain Jack's Deadweed Brew from Bonide. Learn more at CaptainJacks.com.
Roger.
Dan, I think you're pulling the wrong one.
I'm ready to pull it down now. There was still a little bit left in me.
Okay, don't hold it quite so tight. Next one.
Stand by. Damn, I think you're pulling the wrong one. I'm ready to pull it down now. There was still a little bit left in me.
Hi! Welcome to the podcast. This is how it's going to start.
Hey everybody, welcome.
This is the second starting of the Live to Tape podcast, also known as the Executive Buffet. Even better known, it's Daddy's Big Red Truck pulling into the station. It's a truck that can ride on the train tracks, got those special ass wheels. Hey, I'm Kevin Tipcorn, also known as Jason Pepperhouse, also known as, any name you want to call me. His name is my name too. Johnny Pemberton here on Live to Tape. You are in the Executive Buffet. Thank you for being here. This is a wonderful space, wonderful sound space to be in. We're happy to have you here. A couple items of note. If you're new, settle in. We've all been new at times. It's okay to be new. So it's exciting to have you here. Also, if you want to check us out to get more stuff, than just this, and it's not just more podcast stuff. It's more like kind of everything I do because I put it all in the same place. It's patreon.com/live to tape. That's patreon.com/live to tape. And we have all kinds of new access to everything that has come before you. Check it out. patreon.com/live to tape. Exclusive mixes, music mixes, playlists, also access to merchandise. It comes out, about every once in a while, but you get access to it there. Okay. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so yet. That helps everybody out. Also, you should know I'm going to be doing some live shows coming up here. I will be in Portland, Oregon in June on the 13th at Helium Comedy with my dear friend Barry Rothbard. We'll be doing a show together and in Portland on June 13th at Helium. Check it out. And the next day we'll be in Arcata, California on the 14th. We don't have the venue locked just yet, but I mean, it's not a very big place. You'll figure it out. And we might be in San Francisco area on the 15th. Okay, so just keep your eyes open. And some more stuff coming in July and definitely for the fall. So just keep me ready for that. I'll have the I'll post all that stuff on Instagram and Twitter like crazy. My Instagram is Johnny_Pemberton and Twitter is just Johnny Pemberton. So if you want to stay abreast of those situations for live dates, go follow me on those places. And also just keep listening to the podcast and all stuff like that. Have an amazing podcast for you here today. A repeat guest. He hasn't been on in a long time. I think maybe it was actually Twisting the Wind days. Ryan Nasichuk. He's a brilliant botanist, gardener, plant scientist person who we talked many, many years ago. I think a two-part episode, actually. So if you want to, you can check that out still. You got to check it out because it's so good. And today we talked again, and he's doing all kinds of amazing stuff. I'm so happy to share this with you. It's a great time to to get into gardening. I feel like it's always a good time, but right now is especially a great time, especially if you live in like a northern region. Right now, stuff's just, it's not too late. It's not too late to get some stuff in the ground right now. It's so easy and so fun. I mean, you can hear us jaded gardeners talking a little bit about it, but when you first get into it, man. So hopefully that can inspire you, and hopefully you enjoy this, my conversation with Ryan Nasichuk here only
on Live to Tape.
Hello, Johnny.
Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great. It's
working. Am I coming through? It's working? It sounds okay?
Yeah, you sound like a classic phone call. It sounds great.
Wonderful.
Cool.
So I guess the audio will be lower quality from my end, but you're going to record it like pro equipment. Is that how that works?
I guess so. Yeah, you could say that. But it's all going to be mixed together. It'll sound good. I feel like it's a good sound. The sound of a phone to me is better than like digital, like degraded digital. So I'd rather have a phone that's like a lower, you know what I mean? It's like, it just sounds better. It's like compressed.
Okay. I think I understand. Yeah. Instead of that glitchy sound.
Yeah, exactly.
A poor digital signal. That
exactly,
makes sense.
Yeah. Cool.
I wonder if it's an aesthetic that people will maybe long for in the future. Maybe it'll become something that people are nostalgic for.
I think they
are. Sort of a more lo-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm one of them. Like, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Are you into lo-fi music and sort of drony, glitchy kinds of sounds in music?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, cool. Right on, me too. Well, how's your garden?
My garden's doing pretty good. I mean, it's actually kind of busting out right now. I've got I've got some peas, some shelling peas that's hard to let them, because I've been growing peas for a while, but not like, you know, I'm not like a pro at them, but I feel like I've done them enough. I always grow the same variety. I grow this variety called Champion of England.
Yes.
You know that variety?
Yeah, I do know that variety.
That's so funny. Yeah. They are like the best shelling peas for some reason. They're like, when you get them right, they're just like, they're really sweet, and they're super productive, and the vines get really big.
Oh, wonderful. Are they like 6-foot-plus vines?
Yeah. Right now, they're probably about 5 feet, maybe something like that.
But okay.
Upper end of my trellis, so they're kind of having a little bit of trouble staying upright.
Are they doing that flop at the top of a trellis where they grow up and then flop down?
Some of them, yeah. Some of them have done that.
I love that.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing, because it's like, you almost have like this S curve, because it bends over, then it grows back up based on its own thing. Such a strange arrangement.
They're so beautiful. Peas are the most beautiful plants, that soft green color and nice flowers, and it's nice to gaze upon peas. When did you sow peas in Los Angeles?
Probably, gosh, this is the part of gardening I'm bad at, is doing like the Martha Stewart thing where you have like, oh, March 10th, I put the peas in. You know, March 20th, we did this, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I did them probably about 2 months ago, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
It's hard to say.
That's so interesting. From my latitude, that's a fascinating thing to consider, that you sowed them 2 months ago and they're 5 feet tall now. I'll sow mine in 2 weeks, probably.
Yeah, but I'm sure that, I mean, I always feel like, as much as we have that second spring here, we can grow so much stuff. There's also the the thing where it's like, it also gets so hot in the late summer here where you can't do a whole lot.
So do tomato plants wither and things like that?
Everything.
Or can they carry on?
They can.
Really?
A lot of times I feel like you have to set up a some type of a shade screen for them, because it just, the sun is so punishing.
Wow.
Yeah, because I think a lot of times what happens is people buy these plants that say full sun, but it's like not full sun in like the valley or any place in Southern California. I feel like if you get full sun, then it's just going to roast them, especially if they're in pots or something, you know, because you just can't, the plant can't drink enough. It's so heat stressed.
Wow. That's an interesting conundrum. That's do gardens go largely sort of brown and dormant for like 2 or 3 months at that time of year?
I wouldn't say it goes much brown, as I feel like it's only certain stuff does well. And I think it's like, if I start something too late, then it will, or if I start something too early and it's like I sort of miss the mark as far as like harvest goes, then they'll kind of get really baked and brown. Or if I start it too late, they're not established enough to handle the heat. So then they get knocked down. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's such a different challenge from what I've been faced with.
Because you're island, right? Isn't that right?
Yeah. I'm on an island. I'm at 50 degrees latitude. So I'm at sort of, well, there's agriculture happening above 50 degrees in some parts of the world. But it seems, from my understanding, most of the agriculture happening in the world is lower latitudes, really.
Right.
And so the day length change over the course of the year is fairly extreme, and the winter times are pretty gloomy. I mean, very much like the same latitude as the northern United States, excluding Alaska, I suppose, because Vancouver's at 49 degrees.
Oh, so you're just north of Vancouver, basically.
Yeah, I think as the crow flies, it's probably roughly 200 kilometers, maybe more, maybe a little bit more. Probably less than 300, though. And the climate is very similar. I think our summers are a little bit drier because of the location of mountains on Vancouver Island. Because my island is between Vancouver Island and the mainland. And there's mountains up, like along Vancouver Island, there's a mountain range. And I think a lot of moisture is dropped there before it gets to my island after it crosses the Pacific.
What is the island?
So it's a Quadra, Q-U-A-D-R-A.
Okay.
It's closest to the town of Campbell River. Campbell River is a town, like a mid-sized town on the east coast of Vancouver Island. And we've got a couple thousand people. No one seems totally sure. 2,000 to 3,000 people, maybe. And a lot of rocky land with very thin soil and coniferous trees. And a tricky place to get crops to grow. Very deficient in a lot of minerals. And very deficient in actual soil depth, too. Because the coniferous trees have evolved to live here, I think, largely through means of fungal symbionts.
Wow.
And so we, as a result of that, we have tons and tons and tons of mushrooms and tons and tons and tons of big, beautiful coniferous trees. But raising certain crops poses huge challenges without really amending the soil and making some pretty serious changes to the growing condition.
So you do have to do that then, don't you?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And ideally we should be gardening on sites that have deep soil, but not everybody really has that opportunity. Like, I moved a couple of years ago, and the last place I was gardening was flat and had unusually deep soil for this area and lots of water and lots of sunlight. But now I'm gardening an east slope that is probably less than half the soil depth of topsoil and is significantly cooler. So it poses challenges, but it also presents opportunities. And that's been an interesting thing to unpack, like which vegetables I really want to focus on in different gardens. And I'm more and more interested in green leafy vegetables and winter vegetables.
Yeah, that's the thing I like. I have a lot of spinach going right now. And I have a lot of garlic. The garlic, I made a mistake. I put too much in because now it's taken up all my space. And I'm not going to harvest it until like probably August or something. But the... Isn't that the case with the garlic? It takes quite a pretty long time, like to mature.
Yeah, I'm very interested when you would harvest garlic down there, because here we harvest it typically at the very end of July or early August.
Okay,
and we plant it in October, November, usually.
October, so it stays through the winter, right?
Yeah, here it sends down a root. If you plant it in October here, what it does is it sends down a surprisingly deep root, and it kind of starts to send up a shoot, but oftentimes you can't even see that shoot until late winter here. And then In February, typically here, we can see little green shoot poking up, and then it's growing full steam ahead in like late spring, early summer, and then it just begins to dry down at the end of July.
Yeah, I think it's pretty similar here, actually.
Oh, that's interesting. Do people grow it a lot? Is it a common crop there?
I don't think so. No, I think it's a lot. Mm-hmm. There's too much patience involved, and I'm kind of regretting it too, because it's like that thing where it takes up all this space, but the time I could grow two things in the same time. I could grow two harvests in the same time I get one from the garlic.
Yes, with things like spinach or some other fast growing vegetable. Yeah, that it does take up a lot of time, doesn't it? Yeah, when I think about that, that's almost an entire year to just one thing. Yeah, some of the alliums, like we grow a lot of leeks here. I love leeks, and we plant them in February under lights, and then put them out into the ground in roughly April, and then harvest them autumn through winter and finish harvesting in about March or April. So that's upwards of 13 months dedicated to one thing, and a bit less than 13 months in the ground, but almost 12 months of bed space.
Yeah,
that's an interesting way to think about gardens in a sort of temporal way, thinking about them as blocks of time.
I think about it a lot, because for me, it's like I look at it so much. I think about, like, because now everything's popping up and I want to have arugula. I want to have like beans. I want to have all this other stuff, but I have to like make new space. So I have a bunch of these grow bags, you know, like the weed growers use. I have a bunch of those to like, I've been expanding my garden out into these grow bags. I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was like, I was sure that this was going to be a new self-sustaining lifestyle, because, you know, no one had any idea how long this was going to last or the extent of it, whatever.
So yeah.
I was planning for the long haul.
Okay.
And so I got tons of these grow bags, and I had the entire driveway was like filled with grow bags.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what kind of medium are you using in them? What sort of potting soil do you fill them with?
Well, just a bunch of different stuff, but, you know, like different, some stuff I buy and some stuff it's like I amend it with my home compost too.
So okay.
It's pretty good. I guess sometimes I'll even dig up some just dirt from the ground to kind of give it, so it's not super rich. Like for some of those things like beans or the, some of those vegetables, I feel like I was told that. I heard you say I was always told about garlic, and I cut you off. And I can't stop thinking about what we were about to say.
Oh, what were we saying? Garlic, I was told. Oh, I don't know where I was going with that. My brain is
harvesting
full of
garlic, or the time you have it in, or something like that, when it comes
vegetable
up.
Vegetable stuff. What was I going to say? I don't know.
Oh, and maybe it must have not been that important then. I was waiting for some ancient grain of garlic wisdom to be like, I was always told that when you see the three leaves emerge, then you know that the spring is on the mount for
Yes. That kind of thing, that kind of folksy gardening thing. Oh, gardening is full of that, isn't it? Yeah. What did my uncle always say to me? When the alder leaves are the size of what's some coin that doesn't even exist anymore? It was like a 50-cent coin or something obscure. When the alder leaves reach that size, it's time to fish for trout. And then people here always also say that when the forsythia plants are blooming, it's time to plant peas. And some people say it's time to plant time to prune your roses at that time too. That's a fascinating thing to think about. That's an interesting way of thinking about the world through the timing of plants.
Yeah.
I find that very comforting.
Yeah, to me, because I was thinking about that a lot recently, because I put in a bunch of stuff over the winter. I put in a bunch of things, a bunch of vines. I put in this, it's a decorative grapevine. I think it's called a Rogers Red, like a Vitis. I can't think. Isn't Vitis the prefix for all grapes or something like that?
Yeah, Vitis is the genus of grapes. So Vitis vinifera, or maybe it's pronounced vinifera, I'm not sure. That's the European wine grape.
I think this is Vitis Californica. Vitis.
Oh, interesting. I've not heard of that one.
It's like
with
wild
a beautiful
grape.
Leaf?
Yeah, it has these beautiful, like, this one's called a Rogers Red, and it has, like, these really cool red leaves that look like fall, but they're not fall. It's just they look like they're, you know, they're red like fall. And I put one of those
wonderful,
in the
all
ground.
Year.
Yeah, Vitis Californica, Rogers Red. I put it in, you know, 6 months ago, and it's been sitting there dormant. And I was like, I'm sure this thing is dead. I'm sure it's dead because I saw my other grapevine, my Concord grape, coming up. And I was like, oh, my God, this sucks. I spent so much money on this damn thing. It's not coming up. And now, you know, lo and behold, I'm just impatient. And I think just because the weather is starting to get nice and I see some stuff coming up, then it's not going to happen. And, you know, it's budding like hell now. It's going to go crazy.
Great.
It's just so
funny. Isn't that wonderful that it has its own sense of time?
Yeah, that stuff to me is it's almost eerie just how these plants can do that, how they have this built-in clock. And it's so it's so confusing how it's possible that they can all do this, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot about this. It is confusing. It's almost humbling in a way. As a human, I find, to watch these cycles occur and to realize that the cycles are occurring completely. I have nothing to do with them. And the plants in question couldn't be less concerned with my existence. They have their own prerogative, and they're working with these systems that I guess people study them. It's not my realm of expertise at all, but they feel very mysterious to me, some of these cycles and triggers. And it's humbling to think about that in a way. Yeah, I find it very helpful as a way of being less human-centric, less anthropocentric. Is that the word?
Yeah,
when
I think so.
We focus everything on human beings and the priorities of human beings and think of ourselves as sort of the apex of the creatures in the world. And something about witnessing those cycles and those rhythms of plants and gardens, I find, can periodically take me out of that in a way that's very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, though. These words are coming out of my mouth, and I'm not sure if I'm articulating even what I mean.
No, it does. It makes total sense. I agree with you. When I think about that, it's like...
Have you felt that? Yeah?
Yeah, definitely, where it's sort of I guess a lot of it's also, for me, when I see stuff growing... Some stuff you can't stop no matter what, like it's going to grow, and some stuff you just can't help. You can't make it grow. Like I couldn't make that I couldn't make that grapevine start budding. I don't know. I mean, maybe I could. Maybe if I put a ton of like intense lights on it, but would that even tell it to bud? Because it doesn't have any really photo. It was totally bare. There's nothing but brown wood. So would it know that like that the light has changed, or would it have, is like a heat thing? I mean, the things that have to do to manipulate it would be so much effort for something that does it effortlessly on its own. Right.
Yes. Yes. It would require massive intervention on your part, total climate change probably, and light change to trick it to do what you wished. Yeah. And we do that too. I guess that's another part of it, is that we are heavily interventionist in some ways in horticulture sometimes.
Right.
In growing certain plants, we will create wildly unnatural conditions just to make them grow at all. It's really something to think about, how we're completely dependent on these creatures. And most of us, myself included, and I've been gardening for a long time, you've been gardening for a long time, we still have an incomplete picture of it at best. Mm-hmm. But we rely on them every day for our direct sustenance. I really am interested in speaking with more people who are just getting into gardening. I find that to be a really wonderful thing. Like I have a question for you as someone who lives in a city and who's interested in gardening, and I'm assuming, I don't really know, like probably know a lot of people who at the very least like to eat vegetables. What do you think are ways that people can get into gardening? People who are maybe curious but haven't taken any sort of plunge, or people who are intimidated by the process, like what would be your advice for those people?
I always tell people to try to grow something that they want to eat, like that they really want to eat, maybe like two or three things, because that makes them invested in the plant. But I also, sometimes I think the opposite too, is you should try growing something you don't, I have tea leaves in my throat. You have to grow something you don't want to eat, because that way you're not doting on it so much. Because I think when people tend to, new gardeners tend to overwater and like be impatient with the way things grow. And
yeah,
That to me is like the thing I always think, because people always ask me all the time about stuff like that, because I kind of developed a reputation, even though it's like I don't really know that much. I know just enough. But I think the biggest thing I've found more than anything is just to make sure you're growing something in the right season. Because so many people, it seems like they or like they'll tell me like, yeah, I just got some tomato plants. And it's like it's November. And I'll tell them, yeah. Well, you shouldn't. No place should be allowed to sell you those in November because you can't grow them unless you have a fucking massive hydroponic indoor grow system, which seems to be like for tomatoes, really? Is that what you're going to, I mean, that's not really meant for tomatoes. It's meant for one thing, and that's a cash crop. So
yeah, for sure.
It's like a thing where I feel like so many people get discouraged, including myself, until like very recently. There's a bunch of stuff I just didn't realize. Like I've been casually growing garlic for a long time, but this is the first year I was like, how come sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't? And then I realized, oh wait, I'm planting this willy nilly. I'm not paying attention to the seasonal requirements of the plant. And for the first time ever, I did that. And now I have all this like super robust garlic that's going crazy out there. And it's all because I planted it at the right time instead of just, because I would put it in a lot of times just to keep pests away. Like I'll put it in the corners of my bed to kind of keep pests away. The same way I would plant like marigolds or something.
But oh yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I never planted it. I think I had some success like 10 years ago. When in one of my beds, I just probably happened to plant the garlic at the right time. And I was able to net, you know, probably like 5 or 6 bulbs, you know, it was pretty cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that to me is like the biggest thing is the timing issue. Because sometimes it's like you're expecting people are trying to grow something. And I'd be like, you should not expect, there's no way in hell you're going to get anything from that plant because it's not going to grow right now. It's just not the time for it.
I think that's a very good strategy to focus on seasonality first. That makes a lot of sense. And to get people to consider that, because you're right. People often don't consider that, do they? Your tomato example is very interesting because here the equivalent is with winter vegetables. And people will come to me in October and say, I've just planted all of my kale and chard and such for winter. And
but really?
They're 2 months, like we want to have kale and chard in and early July at the latest in my garden, maybe a little bit later, but people will talk to me 2 months later because they've gone to a nursery and they've bought some pot bound little winter vegetable starts and they'll plant them and they won't do anything because the growth here at this latitude, growth effectively stops by Halloween and even for very hardy winter things. And then it doesn't really start again until sometime in February. So yeah, there's misconceptions, isn't there? Misconceptions that we can put things in whenever or that their cycles will bend to our whims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or if you fertilize it enough, and like that to me is the thing I've learned so much about recently. Just the idea that sometimes you just can't make a thing grow, but sometimes it also it's just so happy you can't stop it.
Yeah, that's a nice way of looking at it, and of dealing with the fact that there will be inevitable failures. Mm-hmm. I've had a few vegetables like that. I think it's often heat where I live, but okra refuses to grow. I'm going to try again this year.
That's
but
funny.
Okra just shrugs.
Yeah, I would think it's just way too cold for okra there, isn't it?
Too cold, yeah. Even at the hottest time of year, I had some plants that I babied along, started them indoors for months, put them out at the hottest time of year, or right before the hottest time of year, and they were out there in the heat, in full sun, and they did like really almost nothing, as if they were almost offended at the conditions. That was the feeling I had looking at them. Can you grow it well?
Oh yeah, I've been actually. That's like probably the one plant I've had the most success with is okra.
Oh wow!
Okra and eggplant. This last year, I had an eggplant volunteer show up, and I don't understand. It's the biggest fucking thing I've ever seen. It grew right in the middle of the bed. I recognized it from what was a tiny seedling. I was like, oh my God, I think that's an eggplant from last year. And I just nurtured it. I put some bricks around it so it didn't get mowed over. And it just fucking got huge. I must have pulled like 40 eggplants off there, maybe 50 eggplants off there. It was a Japanese eggplant, I think, or a Chinese eggplant.
50 eggplants?
Yeah, because
it
just kept fruiting over time.
Wow.
They're not super
big. That's wonderful.
That and I had a
squash
plant.
Did it survive?
Did it survive? I mean, it didn't survive because like, it got so big that I feel like, you know, I dug it out and cut it back at the, you know, at the end of fall. Because it also takes up so much space, so much goddamn space.
Oh, so it just sprawled out like feet in either direction?
It was huge. It was just really big.
So do people ever get them? Will they ever overwinter with protection in your climate, or do they usually die sometime in the middle of winter early winter?
I think you can overwinter literally anything here. I've overwintered. I have hot peppers and I have box peppers that have overwintered for probably about 5 years now. I think that the plants, I don't know, because the hot peppers are habanero and they're so hot. I can't even eat them. Like no one can eat them. So it's kind of like a thing where it's more of a novelty that I grow those. The box pepper, I don't know if it's happy or not. I still have it in the ground. It's probably going to start budding soon, but I've been cutting it back and the stalks are really thick and kind of gnarled. And I've had that for probably like 3 or 4 years in that same spot. And I wonder, actually probably 2 years, but that's maybe three years. Yeah. Three seasons with that box pepper. I just wonder if maybe, I don't know if it likes that or not. I mean, it will fruit and it will grow, but I don't know if it's optimal for fruit production or not. It's all just like an experiment. And I haven't really done any research about it, but I think it's one of those things where I have trouble. California is weird because stuff will just stay alive. And I have trouble, like, for me, it's hard to just justify ripping that out of the ground when I see, like, this thing is still alive. It's still being successful and somewhat productive. So, but maybe
that resonates.
Yeah. I'm sure someone might tell me, you know, an expert like you would be like, yeah, well maybe it's, I don't know, maybe something's happening with the plant that changes its nature.
Yeah. I hesitate to say I'm an expert at anything. I think I've decided that I'm fully not an expert and I'm feeling more and more that way to the point where I think I'll eventually change careers entirely. But I'm very curious about that, whether there's a decrease in vigor and yield, like, cause they're fast growing plants. I mean, I always think of them as annual plants because of my climate, but I think it's certainly plausible that they would decrease in yield after a couple of years. I wonder about that. The only time I ever saw, I saw these eggplants much closer to the equator, probably at 20 degrees latitude or 15 or something. In the tropics, I saw someone show me their 3-year-old eggplants once, and they were these.
Wow.
They were tree-like.
Like a bush.
I remember they were in the courtyard. Okay. Yeah, arching upwards. They were arching upwards, and I remember walking amongst them in the. They were in like the courtyard of a farmhouse out in the countryside.
Where was this?
And being totally. This was in Myanmar.
Oh wow. Okay, that's like the eggplant. And I remember, eggplant zone for real.
They grow some cool eggplants in that part of the world. They really like to grow, they grow many, many types, but they like to grow tiny little ones.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some that look like clusters of, I think they might be a different species. There's some that look like clusters of, they almost look like pepper, like not green peppers, but like black pepper, like clusters. Have you ever seen that? Like a spray of little, maybe spray is not the right word, like clusters.
Yeah,
a little green
like,
thing.
Almost like grapes in a way, but it's a little bit bigger,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes. But these ones were little eggy-shaped ones, I think. They grew fabulous watermelons, too. That was in Shan State in Myanmar. And wonderful melons, watermelons. I'm really keen to figure out a way to spend some time at a lower latitude at some point in my life and spend at least a year to try to grow crops somewhere further south, because I feel like that will be very, very illuminating. And I think so much about latitude and day length. And
yeah, it's such a big thing, isn't it?
It's huge. And it never was really, I shouldn't say never, it came up very seldom in my education, using the term education very broadly. Like, it came up very seldom at school. It came up very seldom in books I have read. It does come up once in a while. Other gardeners very seldom talk about it. And I think it's enormous, and I think the implications of it are massive, and I think it would be, like, without hyperbole, probably one of the best experiences of my whole life to go to 20-something degrees latitude or even 10 degrees, maybe even the equator, but I think that brings a whole other education, too, I think. But I think the subtropics or somewhere in that area would be very fascinating to cultivate plants and to see what other people are growing and to see the plants that are not used that commonly for cultural reasons. That's another thing I'm realizing is that what people grow in their gardens here, at least, I can really only speak for here, but I guess everywhere, is dictated. It's not just dictated by growing conditions and climate and technical stuff, but it's dictated by what people were taught and what is part of their food culture. And I'm increasingly becoming convinced that there's all of these crops that would be welcome, like they would be folded into my local food culture here if they were introduced and if they were grown. Like the only thing that's preventing them from existing in my local food culture is, culture is not quite the right word. Like they don't exist here because people weren't taught about them, basically.
Yeah. Isn't also some of that stuff is just simply like you're talking about okra. The reason you don't have okra there is because it just doesn't grow.
Yeah, some of it is that, but I'm thinking of the things that are not that. Like okay. some of the things that don't exist. Like I'm the more I garden, the more I feel like it's a very long list of things that could grow here, but do not for reasons other than climate, soil, technical stuff.
Oh, because people don't want them because they don't know about them.
Yes, and they're not part of the history, and they're not part of the past. Because I feel like so much of what I ate up until, I don't know, up until my early adulthood, I suppose, so much of what I ate and what I cooked, and still to a large extent, was just a product of my parents and my grandparents and our culinary history and such. And that list of plants, though, it's not a single list. It's a little list in my head for my area. It contains some gems, like some things that one that jumps to mind is a couple of fruits, or two that jump to mind are persimmons and mulberries, both of which will grow very well here, but are not commonly part of what people want to eat.
Weird. That seems like kind of odd that wouldn't be that wouldn't be something.
It does seem odd, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the same.
But there's other. It happens in other. Yeah, but do mulberries grow well in LA?
They grow like crazy, but you only see them coming from Turkey for the most part, I feel like.
Ah, yes. Okay. So a place where they exist as a common part of the food culture.
Right.
And it's definitely, I think this is, I don't want to say universal, but I suspect that this is something that I feel like there's lists in other places too, where people would potentially be very interested in eating them. Like we're not the only, my area is not the only place where we have these sort of plants that have not become part of the food culture, but maybe could. I think it happens all over the place with different plants. So.
Oh yeah. I mean, cause I feel like you could probably grow, you can grow almost anything in the desert if you have water, right? Cause that's like a thing where that's isn't like the Central Valley in California is essentially a kind of a desert, but they irrigate everything cause they get so much goddamn sun that they can grow anything. So they can just, that's all cash crops that are growing up there. So.
Yeah. Do you ever drive through there? Have you ever taken a trip through that area?
I have. Some parts of it are honestly extremely bleak and terrible. It's the kind of thing where it's full on industrial agriculture. It's not good. Parts of it are just really gross and bleak and just, yeah, it's not really, it's sort of like the underbelly of California in a way. It's like where so much work goes on, but at the same time, it's also just very, it's just all these industrial farm operations. And so it's really flat and it's really, really hot. I'm talking like Modesto or like Bakersfield, like these areas. I mean, some of Bakersfield because it's up against the mountains, but it's just super, super hot and it gets really, there's not a lot going on there. I mean, there's other places closer to there's just so much going on in California that's kind of like it's overwhelming, but that's definitely a part that's not considered, it's not super, like no one's going to vacation in Fresno, that's for sure. They're just not.
I think
it's like, it's not pretty.
Yeah, it's flat and bleak. I think I might belong to a very small group of people who would conceivably vacation there.
You might, but also here's the other thing about it is there's a lot of pollution. There's a shitload of pollution that happens because of all the industry and all like the stuff that goes on there, and it gets trapped because of the mountains. And so A lot of times, Central Valley in California has some of the worst air quality in the state, if not the country, because of
Oh,
that
wow.
effect. So you sometimes you drive through there and you're just like, this looks gross that I'm breathing. I'm breathing this stuff, you know?
Oh, I had no
Yeah.
idea about that.
I think
Oh,
it's
I assumed
yeah,
that the
it's
air was relatively clear there.
no, only at the coast really. I mean, this changes a lot, and also I don't know about this for sure, but I know to some extent that I'm always checking the air quality in like Bakersfield and Fresno and stuff like that just to see how bad it is. Because it can be really bad
Oh,
in those
wow.
places because of the valley effect. But at the same time, it's also, I mean, also the heat makes it, the fact that it gets really hot, I think, affects it as well. But it's,
I imagine.
yeah.
Well, that must shut down. That's something I'm interested in. Like, it's very sunny, but it gets extremely hot at some times of year. Do they basically let some of those fields go fallow during the very hottest months and then replant in like late summer, autumn?
I'm not really sure, actually. I know that they probably do a lot of winter farming. Yeah, I bet they do because it's so hot then. But they can grow the hell out of strawberries and stuff in the middle of the winter because it's enough heat, and they can trick it all, you know? It's enough
Yes.
to so some of those plants that are like temperate that you would grow like in the summer in northern latitudes, you can grow throughout the entire winter in places like the Central Valley in California. So I think that's what the mainly what they do is they do stuff like that because they
Oh, that's
can, you know?
fascinating.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I was reading recently that there's another place like that. I think it's the area surrounding Yuma, Arizona, if I recall
Oh,
correctly.
wow. Okay.
Apparently produces a lot of the winter vegetables, like things like romaine and iceberg lettuce and stuff. And the industrial scale winter vegetables, apparently a lot of them come from there too.
It makes sense,
I
yeah,
think
because they
that would
had
be so interesting to see.
to check out the industrial winter farming.
Yeah, very
Yeah.
much. I think I'm totally fascinated by industrial farming. It's not something that I'm involved in other than to watch it, but I'm increasingly drawn to seeing that, like where food comes from at great scale and what that means for, yeah, what that means for us, for people, because it feels, I don't know, like it feels like great big giant fields are going to keep being cultivated no matter what happens. And
Yeah.
I'm interested in the implications of that and who's doing that and the ethics of that and what that means for the surrounding communities and the water. And yeah, I would like to explore that more and see more of that. There's something terrifying about it and also totally alluring.
Yeah, I see what you're
And
saying. It's yeah, there's like a combination of things going on there.
yeah, it's a combination of things, and it's almost a feeling of dissonance in my mind. Like I sometimes look upon a big green field of food and think like there's something wonderful about it too. But it's also really scary to see like a sprayer go along and spray unknown mist,
Yeah.
some type of pesticide, maybe, probably, maybe something benign, maybe something extremely toxic, often not possible to ask. Yeah, I want to see more of that. Where would you, like, if you were to pick another climate or another place to try gardening for a little while, like, do you ever think about that? Is there a place that
Oh
you'd
yeah,
be
I think about
keen
all
to
the
try raising
time.
vegetables? Where would it be?
I'd want to grow someplace in the north where the summer is shorter, but it's like, you know, maybe even I grew up in Minnesota, maybe even someplace that far north, or maybe like what I think probably is the best place to grow in America, at least from my perspective, at least what I think is someplace like Missouri or like Tennessee, because they have snow. They have a clear winter, so you have to stop. You know, you have to stop what you're doing. But the summers are super wet and super hot, and they just have like such rich soil from all like, you know, like what do they call that? Like the glacial activity from whenever the hell that was. So they have this super rich soil, and you can just grow all this stuff. I would think it'd be cool to try to grow there. I just would love the idea of
Very.
having an actual winter where instead of feeling like I have to always be gardening, there's a time where it's just like, hey, nothing's growing right now, so there's nothing to do. Like, take a chill, you
Yes,
know?
yes. Well, I at some point will be trying to sublet my place for a year, and it will come with a garden and chickens. So if you'd ever be interested
Okay.
in trying a gloomy winter, a gloomy maritime winter, there
Yeah.
might be an opportunity.
So you have chickens in your garden, huh?
Yeah, well, I live at my friend's place. I moved here a couple of years ago, and they're more his chickens, but he has this flock of chickens, but they're not in the vegetable garden. They're sometimes in part of the orchard, but they're fenced out of the vegetable garden. And I wonder about what would happen if we let them in the vegetable garden. I know people do let them in their vegetable gardens, but I think they scratch a lot.
Yeah.
And I know they scratch a lot. They would make a mess, I think.
I guess they can do good and bad, right? I guess you can like let them out for a limited amount of time and they'll get a bunch of grubs and stuff. They'll get some bad stuff, mm-hmm. but then too much time, they'll just tear it up, huh?
I suppose, yeah. I suppose that's why people use chicken tractors.
What is that?
Have you ever seen a chicken tractor? A chicken tractor is it's a structure. Usually it's a movable structure, sometimes on wheels, and it's a kind of a simple framed chicken coop that you can move over a certain square footage of land. So you can take it and, for instance, you can build them so that they fit over one of your vegetable beds, for instance. Right. I've heard of it being done this way. And then you can put your chickens in the tractor, and the only area that they're able to roam around in is, it's constrained by the chicken tractor. So they do their grub picking or their digging or whatever in the area you want them to, and then you can just move the tractor elsewhere.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
And then cultivate the bed. It's a way of rotating. I've never actually done it, but from what I understand, it's a way of rotating the benefits of chickens through a piece of land, but preventing them from going willy-nilly and just doing as they wish everywhere.
But they also shit everywhere, so that you want that nice shit in the garden too, right?
Well, I guess that's a question I've always had about it. Like I was always taught that it's not a great idea to take fresh poultry manure, or really any fresh manure, and try and plant into soil that's been amended with that immediately.
It's too hot, right? It's too much nitrogen.
It's too hot. Yeah, that's what people always say. It will burn. I think there's other nutritional reasons as well that I'm not sure I have enough of an understanding to articulate, but I think it can cause nutrient tie up of various sorts too, potentially.
And what does that mean?
Well, that's when, I mean, the example of that would be probably more with manure from horses or cows or something where there's a lot of bedding in the manure. So bedding is typically high carbon material used to absorb odors and moisture with mm-hmm. livestock. So it might be, sawdust, or it might be straw or something of that nature. And if you were to incorporate manure that's got a bunch of bedding in it into the soil, what happens is the microbes that are going to be decaying that organic material, they need nitrogen to break down the carbon. So bedding like
it.
Straw, they basically borrow it. So if you have a lot of carbon that you've just dug into your soil, so say the extreme example would be you dig a bunch of sawdust into your soil.
Right.
The microbes would have suddenly, they'd be faced with a ton of carbon relative to nitrogen. There's almost no nitrogen in the sawdust, but there's lots of carbon. So they need nitrogen to build proteins and to basically build their cells. And they need carbon as a food source, carbohydrate energy. And they need both. So to break down that much carbon, they're going to scavenge as much nitrogen as they possibly can from just the soil adjacent to their activities. And temporarily it will be unavailable because it's going to be tied up basically in the bodies of living things for a while.
Oh, okay.
So that's nitrogen tie up. It's not as big of a deal when you lay carbon atop the soil.
Right.
In fact, I don't generally worry about it at all. I think that has to do with you've created a very narrow interface of carbon and soil. And I think that the nitrogen tie up is really probably only occurring pretty close to that narrow interface. But it's when you dig in particularly a high surface area carbon, like something that's a fine particle size, and you mix it in with the soil, I think that's typically when this becomes a big problem.
Wow, okay. That makes... But, yeah, I didn't realize... I knew about this, but I didn't realize why that was the case, and now it makes so much sense. I just didn't realize that all this time.
I'm glad that made sense. I hope I explained it correctly.
Yeah, totally.
I worry with podcasts that there's going to be people who know... I guess it's not something to really worry about, but that there's going to be people who know a lot about this topic potentially listening and saying, no, he got it wrong. So I apologize.
I think that that's... I feel like it's the opposite. A lot of people who don't have any idea listening and they're interested, and at the same time, it's also... It's impossible to say everything right all the time. And
true.
That's what this is for, is to say something wrong and who cares about it.
That's a really nice way of thinking about it. Do you think people are hungry for garden content in podcasting?
I think so. I think a lot of times, anytime I talk about it, people are always interested in it because it's like something where, I don't know, it's just like, it's kind of like it's always interesting because it's never going away. It's always changing. I think there's, like, I know a pretty good amount, but I really know very, very little compared to, like, someone like yourself. And you even say that you don't know anything, which I know is not true.
I don't know anything. I literally don't know a single thing about gardening anymore. That's what I tell people.
Yeah. Which is like the classic thing I always talk about in the podcast. Anyone I talk to who says that, it's like that's that Dunning-Kruger effect where, you know, I play a little piano. It's like you've been playing for 30 years. It's like, yeah, the longer you do something, the more you learn that you don't know, I feel like. And with gardening,
yes,
for me,
yes.
Yeah, people ask me questions and I always say, like, look, I don't really know. I can troubleshoot my own garden, and that's about as good as it gets. And even then, like, I'm really good at diagnosing stuff. Like, I can kind of like sense, like, okay, this seems like something. I can tell this is going on here. I can tell, like, the color of this, the way this smells. But as far as like actually telling people what to do or why it's happening, I never know, really.
I think you're being a little humble. Well, okay. I feel like you have some guidance for people.
My spinach is bolting right now. I don't know why. The leaves are fucking huge. And I kind of think maybe there's too much nitrogen in the soil. A two-cent opinion that maybe that's why it's bolting. Because even it hasn't been hot at all. But it's, and I've been getting a lot of water and the soil's really good. I think maybe the soil's so high nitrogen for some reason that they're getting really leggy, you know? It's like they're just really leafing out, which is kind of good in a way, but I don't know. I just don't know why they're bolting so soon.
Were they from transplants or did you direct seed?
No, I didn't. They were from little transplants, but they're really small and they grew. Yeah, I bought a little 6-pack tray.
I definitely have found that transplanted greens are much more liable to bolt. And I totally don't know why. I have some suspicions, but I found that with spinach in the past many times that I thought I had like created an optimal transplant and hardened it off perfectly and prevented it from getting pop bound or water stressed and all the things you do. And then still had bolting. I think transplanting things, I think that growing things in pots and then transplanting them effectively to the garden in a way that they are not stressed at all, I'm starting to feel like it's actually one of the more difficult things to learn in gardening.
Wow, okay. Yeah,
I think it spoiled a lot of plants.
I've definitely had a lot more luck with direct seeding, for that matter. Like stuff always
yeah,
does
that's interesting.
Better.
Yeah, it does often, doesn't it? This is a thing, I think. This is something that I've been thinking about lately. I feel like a lot of the gardens that I've seen where there's problems, I'm thinking more newer gardeners than you or I, but a lot of the newer gardens I've seen where there's problems, when I dig down and really talk to people about it, I often discover that they've started a lot of their crops in pots, sometimes indoors, sometimes outdoors or in cold frames, but they've started a lot of things in pots. Sometimes they've started things that don't need to be started in pots, and often they've started things that don't want to be started in pots. But it's common that the failures in new gardens, when I really investigate them, some of the failures anyway, can quite often be traced back to what happened when those plants were being produced in pots. Like, it's very hard for people to not inadvertently stress delicate little plants in little pots, particularly in indoor conditions. Like, people here will start, say, broccoli or cabbage or something in the spring, they'll start it under fluorescent lights in their kitchen in warm indoor temperatures, and then they'll move it outdoors sometimes it's still cool at night, like right away with no hardening off period, no transition period. And then the plant will be very stressed right from the get-go, and that will manifest in a poor crop. I see this a lot. It's a tricky problem, though. There's a strong urge to start little things in pots, I found.
Yeah, I guess it's because it's hard. I think people have trouble with certain seeds. I mean, if I start like a big seed, like a squash or something, I don't worry about that. Or beans, I don't worry about that, starting them outdoors. Or like arugula or any kind of lettuce stuff, or basil, that stuff tends to do pretty well from seed outdoors. But the other stuff like spinach or tomatoes or other stuff that I don't really understand the seed as much, those I tend to be like, I don't feel comfortable starting them from seed out. I don't feel comfortable directly sowing them.
Because of a lack of familiarity?
Yeah, I guess because like a bean or a squash, those are such big seeds. You know they're going to germinate if you get them wet enough or long enough, right? And with the small seeds like the arugula or like the carrots or something like that, I know I'm going to be thinning that out. So mm-hmm. I don't worry about germination rate. With stuff mm-hmm. like tomatoes and eggplant and stuff, I don't plan on thinning those out. So that's the kind of thing where it's something that's a small seed that I don't understand exactly how it germinates. That's what I'm nervous about direct sowing.
That makes a lot of sense. I feel like that makes sense. I think I feel the same way about certain plants. Have you ever heard of station sowing?
No, never heard of that.
Station sowing is... it's a word that was introduced to me relatively recently, and it's a concept that maybe is useful for some of those plants. It's the idea that if you've got a plant that you're planting something from seed and you want to direct seed it, but it's a crop that's going to be sitting pretty far apart in the garden, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to sow a row of it for whatever spacing or reasons. Like, so it would be, I think in your climate, an example would probably be a tomato.
Okay.
And tomatoes, maybe not the best example because they transplant very well. So there's not necessarily a need to do this. But station sowing is when you say, okay, I want my tomatoes to be 2 feet apart or 3 feet apart or in whatever particular arrangement. And you select in your mind or with a little stick or with some kind of a marker where each plant is going to stand at the finished spacing. And rather than sow one seed at that spot, you sow a number of seeds, but in that little spot very close together, and you mark the spot. Mm-hmm. And then when they come up and when it's safe enough to thin them, you thin them to one plant per station. So instead of growing a row, and if you have spotty germination in a row, like you don't actually know where you're going to have success along that row.
Right.
This is a way to put all of your seeds, like to hedge your bets in the finished spacing of the plant.
So
does that make any sense?
You plant a couple of seeds in one spot. But like over like, yeah. You know, like the space of like a fist, you plant like five or six seeds.
Or even if they're small seeds, even smaller space.
Okay.
But yes, in a discrete spot. And then your spots are far enough apart that they are like your final spacing.
That makes sense. Yeah. That's totally makes
sense. Yeah, it's a way around it. It's a way around certain dilemmas anyway. Have you ever tested your soil?
I haven't actually. I think that's a big thing. But also my soil changes so much because it's like end of a season, I'll amend it with a bunch of stuff, you know. So it's not like it's really mm-hmm. the soil. Well, I guess I have two different soils. I have the soil that's in the yard, which I only plant a few things. There's very few things I put in the ground here. Most of the stuff I grow is in either in pots or in my big garden bed, which is like, you know, 10 feet by 5 feet kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not tested it, no.
You might find it very illuminating. I'm a very specific type of person, I suppose, but it's fascinating for me to see like with fair amount of exactitude, how much calcium is in my soil and how much phosphorus and, mm-hmm. and what are the excesses and what are the deficiencies. I'm always trying to get other people excited about this, but I don't have a really good way of doing it with words.
Yeah.
But the soil testing is fast and relatively inexpensive these days, and I think fairly accurate. And it's illuminating, particularly the excesses. It's very interesting to see what shows up in excess. Like, I'll often find an excess of magnesium in soils that I test here because people use a lot of lime in this part of the world, and the nurseries here all sell dolomite lime. Is the lime that people sell here because it's been agreed upon, not necessarily with rigid scientific backing, that dolomite is the right lime for this part of the coast. But dolomite lime is a mixture of calcium carbonate and magnesium carbonate. And it's fairly common that we have close to adequate or even adequate levels of magnesium, but severe calcium deficiencies in these parts. And people will add dolomite year after year after year after year, and they'll build their calcium to pretty much an acceptable level, sometimes a minor excess, but they'll bring their magnesium to a fairly severe excess. And I wonder about the implications of that for plant health and human health and animal health.
On a what kind of scale of gardening are you talking about here?
I mostly test people's backyard vegetable gardens.
Okay.
But I'm doing a few more orchards now. I don't have as much knowledge about soil remineralization in the context of an orchard, but I'm trying to learn a bit more right now. But I'm mostly testing people's vegetable boxes and people's in-ground gardens.
So how do
and
you
finding
do that,
that then? They vary. Well, you take a composite sample. So there's a tool, I think an auger is the word. You can use an auger. It's a tool that, or a corer maybe, that takes cores. Or you can also use any kind of flat spade. So the way I do it is I take this flat little tool that I have, and I cut a vertical face into the soil, and then I take a vertical slice of that face, about half an inch wide maybe, and I cut that into a 6-inch core. And I take a bunch of those cores, about 15 or 20 of them per bed or per area that I'm testing, and I blend. Yeah, and I blend them all together, and I send 2 cups of that to the lab, and they test the composite. So you don't, it doesn't work as well if you take just 1 or 2 cores, because you might be inadvertently taking your cores from an anomalous area. Like maybe that's an area where at some point a ton of manure got dropped, or some fertilizer or mineral or a very specific crop was growing. So you sort of even out your results by, you have to do a bit of head scratching sometimes and think about the past of the garden. And I'm usually trying to take one composite sample from an area that's been treated roughly the same way over the past couple of years.
Okay.
So sometimes that looks like one bed. And I often try to take at least one composite sample from fallow soil as well, if possible. So if it's a garden that's in a grassy lawn or a grassy field, I'll often take a composite of the unamended soil as well. And then I can get some useful contrast. And it's also useful data if you're ever going to expand your garden.
Yeah.
But the bare minimum way of doing it is to select an area in the garden and take about 15 6-inch cores and just blend them together and send a couple of cups of that to the lab. It's not a precise thing. Typically we're dealing with ranges. And with some soil minerals, the acceptable range is very broad, like calcium is like that. And with other soil minerals, the acceptable and optimal range is very narrow.
Boron
would be a good example of that. The ideal range is relatively narrow. It's expressed in the parts per million, and it, beyond, above that threshold, toxicity issues develop. But it's a fascinating thing, and it allows you some insight into soil pH as well, which is sometimes oversimplified as, soil pH is to an extent a function of overall mineral balance. So soil pH tells you some things about mineral balance, and mineral balance tells you some things about soil pH in a sense, but the availability of certain minerals is dictated by soil pH. So there's some minerals that are hyper available at high pH and very much unavailable to plants at low pH. So that's another part of the, manganese
is
the classic example in agriculture is manganese.
Okay.
Yeah, manganese becomes hyper available at low soil pH. So one can create a situation of manganese toxicity if there's lots of manganese in the soil, but the pH is also too low. So there's these cool charts that show you this stuff.
Is low pH is acidic, right?
Yes, and high pH is alkaline.
Okay, so is it true that that blueberries and stuff like that, they want an acidic soil, like a fern or a blueberry? And so they want that high manganese, right?
Well, they want a certain type of acidic soil. I'm not sure they want high manganese. Blueberries are often grown in fairly poorly mineralized soils. So blueberries are often grown in soils. Like, for instance, where I live, I was describing this shallow soil that coniferous trees and fungi thrive in. It's low pH. It's usually low phosphorus. It's almost always low calcium and low, frankly, many other things, boron, copper, zinc. But it grows blueberries beautifully. So they're a crop that will grow in soils that for many agricultural crops would be extremely marginal, but blueberries will thrive in them.
So why is that, though? I just started blueberries for the first time this year. I got a couple of, those, they're nice little starters. They're kind of expensive, actually. I think they're like $10 or $15 each. I got 4 of them. I got 4 different varieties, and I started them. I put each of them in these 10-gallon soil bags, and I have 3 of them in one location that's kind of shady, and one that's in a brighter place by my strawberries. And they seem to be doing pretty well. They've all put out leaves and then put out flowers, the first set of them. But that's as much action as I've had so far. And I put a bunch of pine boughs on the top of the soil for like mulch, because I figure like the pine will break down and be kind of acidic over time. And I use some type of soil that these people at the nursery, I go to this nursery, I trust these people a lot, and they said this is the best soil to plant the blueberries in. But otherwise, I'm so mystified by blueberries, because I feel like there's something where, I don't know, I don't understand it, because I know like certain things, like in the past I've grown carrots and like beans, and they seem to like poor soil, right? Like some of those root vegetables tend to, they don't want to have the soil be too rich.
Well, yeah, in a sense, but that can be oversimplified. Like basically what root, this is so great. This is the kind of thing that I just like love to talk about.
Okay.
This is my favorite thing in the whole world. So, and you just brought up so many interesting things at once. This is great. Root crops, for the most part, my understanding of it is that they don't want to grow in soil that has a lot of available nitrogen, a lot of them.
Okay.
And they generally don't want to grow in soil that's been heavily manured relatively recently. And I think those two things are to an extent tied together. Like a heavily manured soil will most likely have a fair amount of nitrogen availability in it. And when I started to take that into account some years ago and grow carrots and beets and parsnips in soil that had not been manured recently, and I started to give them no additional nitrogen and fairly judicious quantities of compost, like pretty small quantities of compost, I found that the roots became sweeter.
Hmm.
So I think it might primarily be a nitrogen issue, but most of those crops don't want quote unquote poor soil with regards to vegetables, because they do like relatively neutral-ish soil, maybe very slightly acidic, and they do like adequate levels of calcium and particularly adequate levels of potassium, among other things, and phosphorus. So we don't want to try growing them on, for instance, an acidic soil. Like they wouldn't thrive in the blueberry soil, but we also don't want to grow them in soil that would be optimized for, what's a good example? Something that likes a lot of nitrogen. Corn is the classic example, or certain leafy crops. That would be too much nitrogen for them. So we want to try and starve isn't quite the right word, because we're not starving them, but we want to tightly control nitrogen with them. But we don't necessarily need to lower the levels of other important plant nutrients. But the blueberries are going to be thriving in a soil that's low in quite a few nutrients. And my guess is that the soil that you put them in is a low pH potting mix that's been designed for that. Like people probably would use a similar mix to grow something like a rhododendron.
Okay,
Rhododendrons and blueberries are actually in the same family of plants, or cranberry, which is a very close relative of the blueberry, or other acidic plants. But the pine boughs thing is also interesting, because you're totally correct. And this is kind of a big part of growing blueberries in many places, is people will use a lot of high carbon mulch. And in so doing, they're encouraging fungal life within the mulch. So high carbon in the environment, like a bunch of chips and sawdust and stuff, is going to be a very healthy environment for many types of fungi. And their exudates, the enzymes that they exude from their hyphal tips, from their, basically their body is a
mycelial
network.
That was a cool bunch of words just now. They exudate some from their hyphal tips.
Yeah, so a fungus is a, in the context of a fungus that we might, I mean, there's all different types of fungi, but in the context of fungi that might form, for instance, mushrooms, or might form a mycelial network through a bunch of high carbon mulch, what they're doing is at the tips of their mycelium, the tip is growing forward, but it's exuding enzymes out of its body into the surrounding environment. I'm using the word body very loosely here, out of its tissue.
Right.
Enzymes are exuded outwards into the environment, and they start to break down the lignin and the other molecules that make up this woody mass that you've used as mulch. And these enzymes trickle down through the mulch and into the soil to an extent. And my understanding is that that's one of the mechanisms by which high carbon fungal growth can help to gently lower soil pH. But they're also, like, I started thinking about, can I try and say something that might not make sense, just sort of experimentally?
Please.
Okay, where did I even read this? I don't know. I think I pieced this together from a couple places, and I always try and say this to people, or I always try and talk about this with people, And it often doesn't work because I think I'm not really like connecting all the concepts correctly. But somebody introduced me to the idea that if you open your mouth, this isn't going to work, but I'm going to try it anyway. If you open your mouth, the inside of your mouth, for instance, is technically outside of your body in the sense that your jaw and your body itself stops, and then there's a kind of a, we've created like a chamber of air around which your mouth is, but which technically is not part, it's not technically part of your body. So we can also conceptualize our whole digestive tract that way, even though it's a bit tricky to do it. But like we sort of picture a, I mean, I'm not a doctor at all, but like a, to me, I think of it as a series of tubes.
Yeah.
And we can think of that as a contiguous area that is outside of your body in the sense that it's a tube and it begins at your mouth and it's kind of something into which your body exudes enzymes and in which digestion occurs. And then we absorb the products of that enzymatic decay through the membranes that make up the tubes, as it were. And in that way, fungi are more similar to us than they are to plants.
Wow.
Because they're exuding an enzyme outwards, and the enzyme is doing its thing outside, in a sense, using the word outside very loosely, and then we are absorbing the products of that enzymatic breakdown back through the membranes and into our bodies. And that blew my mind, because that's part of a series of arguments that people make, that fungal organisms are actually much closer to animals than they are to plants.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard that we share more DNA with a mushroom than we do with like a pine tree.
Ooh, neat.
Or even like a higher organism, even like a, maybe even I don't know if it's mammals, but there's definitely organisms that anyone would recognize as being a higher life form than a fungus, that we actually should have more common historical DNA.
With a fungus?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love that idea.
I guess from what you said, that makes total
sense,
though. Well, because it all goes back to that whole, what's the idea? Is it called panspermia? The idea that the Earth is, all life on Earth came from an interstellar, or what you guess you call it, an alien, or what's the technical word for alien? Extraterrestrial. A fungal or spore inoculation that came from in space, and everything started. It's been built incredibly slowly, but well, I mean, slow is whatever it means. But I mean, in terms of our conception of time, but that's all happened from a fungal network created from an interstellar or an extraterrestrial spore.
I love that so much. Even if that's not what happened, I find that a comforting and deeply calming thing to think about.
Yeah, when I think about it, it's honestly, to me, it seems like, how could it be anything else? Because that, in a way, it kind of makes so much sense that it's boring. Like, of course that makes sense. Like, why would it be anything else?
Well, does it become less boring if one considers that, so it came, it was seeded that way, but what seeded the whatever seeded us? Like the seeds, and this is, I guess, something that people have been pondering and will be pondering forever, but something planted that first seed, or maybe not.
Right.
But it gets really, and will we know, are we going to do it? And will we ever know from where it came? And was it deliberate?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? Is it deliberate or not? And maybe we'll probably never know, as like you and I will probably never know that. But the idea of it is like, it exists. I also think about the idea that, you know, because people always talk about aliens and like, oh, we're going to find alien life forms. When if you look at any garden close enough, you look at any kind of plant or insect, the insect and plant world, that even a level visible to the naked eye is weird and bizarre in its behavior and its looks than anything you could possibly dream up an alien life form doing. So the idea that there's aliens from elsewhere is seems to me just like kind of just a it doesn't make any sense, because all the diversity, if you think about all the diversity on the earth, it's all happened because of isolation and proliferation. Like you look at like an island, like an isolated island like Australia or like Mauritius or some of these islands that have this weird like I was thinking about, you know about this tree called the it's called the Dracaena cinnabarum, I think, the dragon's blood tree.
I know the genus Dracaena because it's a lot of common houseplants, but I don't know anything beyond that.
There's this,
what is this one?
It's called Dracaena cinnabari, and it's this dragon's blood tree. If you saw a picture of it, you'd be like, oh, that tree. It's a crazy-looking tree. It looks like a mushroom, but it's got all these spikes, and the underneath of it, it really does look like a giant mushroom, and it's this crazy looking Arab tree. I think they get the sap of it's used to make an incense because it has red sap. That's why it's called dragon's blood. But
yeah,
it's a super unique tree. It's like very, very.
Does it have a
very
bulbous base? Is the base like a woody round thing, kind of?
Sort of. I mean, it looks like a. It really does look like a mushroom in a way, but maybe if the gills weren't flat on the bottom, if you see a picture of it, it just, I'm not really good describing it. It has like the way the branch, it almost looks like it's been grown in a funnel. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, kind of.
It looks like it's grown in a funnel and it grows in this really unique, very like interesting structure, and has this like, this red sap that's, you know, it's for, I think it's for incense and stuff. And I don't know why it's red, but I don't know much about it. But I know that it comes from this island called Socotra, which is off the coast of Yemen.
Oh, Yemen.
Yeah. So it's this tiny little place. And you think about like this really strange tree developed in isolation on an island that was probably not visited by anything outside of it for God knows how long, you know, probably like a million years or more, you know, who knows how long it's been there. So if you think about like these proliferations that are allowed to happen in a closed system, and if you think of Earth being the same way, anything that happens elsewhere is just the random events of isolated proliferation. So the fact that anything exists means that everything exists. I feel like like this is such a weird tree. Like it looks like so fucking alien, but it's only because it exists. It became that way because it was isolated and it developed over time without any kind of, any sort of massive changes in its environment. Maybe. I mean, I always want to think about like the idea that, just any kind of thing that would develop, there's nothing that, in enough time, everything you can imagine has occurred and will occur because it's just the nature of nature to run all the variables of numbers. If you extrapolate them out far enough, they become a life form.
I think I know what you mean. Like that, any possibility that could be viable will be.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. So it's like it's almost like we have aliens here because this is just. I don't know. It doesn't really make sense. Per se, like explaining it, but I think in the idea, I just always think about the idea that something being alien is kind of absurd because we already have aliens.
Yes. Yeah, that resonates a lot. It's not even something that can be directly explained, I don't think. It's almost a feeling or a vibe. Do you think that we would have, like, to think about, like you said, there's, if you just look, even without a microscope, if you just look at your garden, you'll see this staggering array of life forms, like really amazing. Sometimes I feel like it kind of broke my brain a little bit. Spending a lot of time thinking on that makes a lot of things seem very trivial and silly in the world.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that way? Like sometimes I go out in the garden. I garden a lot at night in the summertime. And I'll go out with a headlamp and I'll just look at the soil sometimes at night in the summertime when it's really warm in like July and August. And there's this endless parade of creatures across the soil, like mostly insects, but all manner of things. Mm-hmm. And I'll look at that and then think about my life or think about my community or country or society at large. And it will make almost everything feel very, very, very silly somehow.
Yeah, totally. It definitely is one of those things where I definitely felt that way a lot in the garden, looking at stuff, because it's almost like the scale, like none of that stuff cares about you.
Yes, 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 yes. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, they don't care about you. Sometimes I also kind of get this feeling from that kind of interaction where I look at the stuff and I feel like, oh, I'm just a camera that moves around. That's all I am. I might as well be like a Mars rover, where I'm just going around observing stuff and I'm like checking it out and looking at it. And at any given time, I can only focus on one thing. And so it's not like really, I don't know. I think the thing that I thought, it's like the most high-minded point is the idea that everything is happening all the time. Like at no point ever is, you know, it's like we're talking right now. We're obviously engaged in this, and this is what we're doing. We can't do anything else at the time. But everything else that exists is also doing something at the same time. So it's like this thing where I've seen like these images of, maybe it's like some Darren Aronofsky movie or something, or maybe it's something else where you zoom in on like maggots devouring a corpse or something like that, where it's just this massive, like it's super busy. If you think about it, that's like everything everywhere all the time is just this massive. On some scale, there is just busyness. It's just like churning. Everything's just churning with activity at all times, mm-hmm. everywhere, at some scale, to where it feels like that time is just being blasting forth at a rate that you can't even comprehend because there's so much activity Ooh. Going on. Like in the soil, like you look at the soil in a microscope and there's just 1,000 things in there and they're all going about just nonstop pursuing whatever it is they're trying to do.
Oh yeah. The microscope level is a whole other thing. Like we would have, I don't know. Thinking about that. Yeah. And thinking about what you just said, the idea of being a camera moving about the earth, or like sometimes people say, the universe experiencing itself, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. That makes me feel like all these different things, and some of them are very good and some of them are very bad. And it makes me wonder what kind of world we've created. Like what kind of world would we have if everybody could peer at how many bacteria, for instance, are in the soil, or everybody could get a glimpse of what's really happening on the Earth's crust at a microbial level and at an insect level and at a smaller level. I don't know if we'd be able to continue having our society. I don't know. I think we would have to rebuild something totally different if everybody got a glimpse of that all at once. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would work anymore. I think a lot of what's super important would start to seem very silly. And I sometimes feel very sad about this. Like some gardening has brought me great joy in my life, but it hasn't been, it definitely hasn't like solved everything. I often have people say to me, oh, you garden all the time. Like that's your main thing. That's your job. That's your passion. You must be very happy. You must be very at peace. And I've not really been happy and at peace in my life generally. And I'm not complaining, but it's not, happiness and peace have not been things that I've had a lot of success in grasping onto thus far. But I wonder, like my perspective has been shifted by looking at those bugs with that headlamp. It hasn't all been good, you know? It also, to me, is almost a call for stillness. A call for doing nothing, a call for non-economic, non-social, non-movement, non-thinking. Maybe meditation is the closest word.
I think that makes a lot of sense, yeah. The idea of, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, just the idea of certain things just not doing well for certain times, mm-hmm. regardless of anything whatsoever, other than the fact of where they are in the latitude or mm-hmm. what time of year it is or what how much light or how much temperature, just things that can't really be controlled except with extreme effort.
Yeah.
The idea that, like, if that's the case, then all these things that we're trying to manipulate, like as a gardener, I feel like there's a lot of stuff. I think for me, gardening a lot of times is just me trying to have some sort of control over something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to exhibit a lot of control, but at the same time, it takes very little effort to get something to do well if its environment is to its liking.
So yeah.
It's almost like you're just observing these things do what they would do anyways. You're just kind of giving them like a little bit of a push. But it looks,
yeah,
to outwardly, it looks like you're doing all this stuff. It's like, well, not really. You just plant the seed. The seed does all the work. It's got all the programming in there. It's got the food it needs to start. It's like, you're not,
yeah,
really doing anything. You're just setting it up.
Yeah. Planting it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, are we the same? Are we also basically largely just going to do what we're going to do based on the environment in which we're planted? And are we analogous to that grapevine, and we're going to send out leaves when the signals within us dictate it, and we're going to drop leaves when the signals dictate it? And are we largely out of control?
I kind of think so. Yeah. Even though I don't like to think so, but I kind of feel like more and more that's just the case.
Yes. Is there liberation in that of some kind?
I don't know. I mean, I think there could be.
Yeah, I think so too.
It goes both ways. It's like that thing where, I don't know. I mean, I think you could look at it both ways. You could decide it's liberating, or you could decide it's a prison. But
yes.
But I guess if you're aware of something, that means you could possibly control it. But it's like that thing. I mean, it's like swimming upstream or something. Where, why would you swim upstream?
Yeah. Yeah, when you could just go with the direction that you're being funneled by the current.
Yeah, go with the flow. Like, you know,
yeah,
wait till the fucking grapevine's going to come back. It's just, you have to wait. It's like
try to make it
come back is so much effort to expend. And what do you get? Do you even get a better product? No, you don't. You just get it at a different time.
Yeah, yeah.
You probably get like a terrible product if you were like, we have to. It's like when they make like, I feel like it's like why you can't create truffles in a lab, or certain plants and animals, certain plants, right? That you just can't see. People just can't seem to cultivate.
Definitely.
And we don't know why.
Yeah,
but it's
lots
just like,
of fungi too.
Yeah, they can't figure it out. I saw something recently about how scientists don't know how eels congregate.
I heard about this. This is the most interesting thing. And yes, they don't know where they didn't have any idea where they were breeding up until very recently.
Yeah, it's
a
crazy.
Lot of
like,
them.
How
are
is
we thinking
that
about the same thing?
Yeah, eels.
Yeah. And it's in the, what is it, the Sargasso Sea, some of them come from?
Really? I don't even know.
Is that the place?
They
yeah,
found
eels
out?
Are not understood. I think they found out for one species. I don't know, because there's a bunch of different types of eels in the world, but I think they found that the ones, I think it might be, I'm probably mixing this all up. Some marine biologist might be annoyed. I think it's a species that exists in parts of the U.S. East Coast and maybe also parts of Northern Europe. And they knew that they were coming from a long way away. And people used to even find the little, there's a word for them, like little baby eels.
Yeah, the micro eels.
But they, yeah, but they didn't know until relatively recently where they came from. And they come from this place that's like very, very, very far away. Because I think it's down, my geography might be off. Like it's like well off Florida, maybe?
It's
I might be
it's
way
the Bermuda
off.
Triangle, right? That's where they go.
Yeah, it's down there. Yeah, down there. The Sargasso Sea. It's a big Sargasso? Sargasso?
Yeah, I just looked it up just now. I saw it. I'm seeing it.
Yeah, and it's like this swirling sea plant place out in the ocean.
Sargassum.
Sargassum. That's the plant, right?
Yeah, it's a genus is Sargassum. Family is Sargassia. Order is Fucales, or I don't know how you say that, Fucales.
I have no idea.
The class is Phaeophysae.
Okay.
The phylum is Orchophyta. So I guess that means, does Orchophyta mean a sea plant?
Oh, heavens, I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah.
Phyta is plant. Phyta, I think, is plant.
And I think orco, here it says orco is a mostly photosynthetic heteroconts. Their plastid is of red algal origin.
Oh man, this is beyond me.
It's way beyond me. But yeah, the eels go down there, and I guess they return with babies, but they don't. I guess they don't know how.
Huh.
I think they don't. They don't know the nature of their reproduction, is what they said. And so, if that's the case, it's like, I guess we're talking about this because we're talking about how there's all this mysterious stuff, or maybe how it's such.
Well,
such
we don't
a,
know anywhere. We went kind of almost maybe nihilist. Maybe that's not the right word. We went into a realm of deep uncertainty. I'm glad we did too, because I feel this deep ambivalence often when I'm gardening, or like ambivalence about this whole project of humanity and what we're up to. And gardening has changed my brain, I think. I don't know if it's good or bad.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's both. It's probably tends toward good because it's not a bad thing. It's not like we're hurting anyone or doing anything. It's definitely like a nurturing of life. But I see what you're saying. I feel like in the same way for me, like it makes you think about stuff in a way that maybe isn't really super congruent with other things. And maybe it can be. I think about this article, this guy. Excuse me, this guy John Jeremiah Sullivan wrote this article about, you know, the guitar player John Fahey?
No, I don't think so.
I think he died in 2001, but he was like he loved folk music. He was like a big time like folk a lot of his recordings were based upon much, much older music, like folk blues, like traditional stuff that was some of the first recordings ever made in the United States. And he and a bunch of his friends and buddies and people, they were like hardcore into recording and collecting all these old, super rare recordings of early music, you know? And he was into recording it too. And this guy, the guy wrote the article about him, was talking about how his opinion, John Fahey and his buddy's opinion on some of this early music wavered between like, this like listening to this one guitar track where you hear this woman singing and no one quite knows what she's saying, but she does this thing with the guitar that they can't quite tell what it is, but it's this incredibly beautiful, interesting sound and melody, to being like to being totally obsessed with it and thinking like this is almost like a Rosetta Stone of sorts, to the opposite of like, well, who cares, it's just some old poor person in the middle of fucking Mississippi, you know, it's nothing, it's like throwaway. Like how they go between, I should read this again, but it's the way he talks about the way these guys feel about this music is how I feel a lot of times about gardening. I also guess music too, is just how it's like, it's the most important thing, but at other times you're just like, who cares? It's like, this is like the plant just doing what it does, you know, it's doing what it does. It's not like there's any mystery to it. It's just the nature of what it is. I don't know how to describe it. It's like a weird, it's like that thing between nihilism and whatever the opposite of that would be, but kind of coexisting.
Ooh, yeah.
like the duality of that thinking.
Yeah, I love it. I love that you can hold those two poles in your mind. I love that we're able to do that as people.
It's
We're
almost like you hold
them
in contempt.
Too.
It's almost like you have some sort of contempt for for some of the plant life and stuff.
Oh yeah.
Because when people are getting all up and people ask you questions about it, all this stuff, it's like, I don't know. You know, it just fucking do it. Just grow it. If it doesn't grow, it doesn't grow. Or it's like, stop thinking about it so much. I'll go from that to being like thinking about it obsessively to the point where it's all I'm thinking about. Like, there've been times when all I could think about was my garden. I'd think about it like day in and day out. I'd wake up thinking about it and go to sleep thinking about it, like planning it, like just stuff like that. To where
that resonates big time.
There's
it
no
can
end.
Draw you in, huh?
Yeah,
that's cool. I love that. That's maybe that's a helpful tip for people who are wanting to get into gardening too and asking your advice is maybe just do it, just start doing it and don't worry as much about it. But easy to tell someone to not worry about it, I guess.
Easy to. Before we wrap up, is there, I feel like we should talk about some more, some real cogent gardening advice.
Oh yeah, we can do that.
Because it's springtime. Sure.
Yeah. People, should I riff a little bit on what I would tell people?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, you probably do tell people stuff all the time, right? So.
I do, but I think I like the idea of starting where you would have the way you answered this question for new gardeners, which is to start with seasonal, start really considering the seasons and look at some planting charts, because everyone now has access to proper timing charts for their area, pretty much in North America anyway. I'm sure in most places you could dig around and find the right charts. Like in my area, people often use the West Coast Seeds chart. It's a seed company and they publish charts for free online. But yeah, to consider seasonality and to consider that what we're growing might not be dictated entirely by what grows well here, but that it might be influenced strongly by the culinary culture of the area, and that we might actually have a much broader palette of plants to work with in terms of edible plants and in terms of ornamentals. We might have a much broader palette of plants from which to choose than we expect by looking around at our friends and neighbors' gardens. Like it may or may not be, but probably is possible that there's a lot of really amazing fruits and vegetables, like really, really amazing fruits and vegetables that we're not growing, but we could be growing. And I think that to me is one of the very most interesting things. And here where I live, I mean, where you live, winter gardens are a much more established idea. But where I live, winter vegetables almost don't exist at all in the gardening culture. Like, people will grow leeks, kale, chard for winter. Sometimes they'll grow parsley and a couple of other things, occasionally beets, carrots, a couple other things. But there's a much, much, much broader spectrum of plants that will work very well in the winter here if they're given very minimal protection. Like, I use low polytunnels that I make with pipe and rebar and pieces of wood, but anything in my climate that puts a piece of clear poly over the bed at the coolest times of year, so where I am, that's like late October through March or April, if the plants are protected at that time of year with clear plastic, we can grow dozens, if not more, well, dozens of different types of winter vegetables, and we can eat them all winter long. And it's like, considering that, I think as part of the season discussion makes a huge difference. And increasingly, that's what I talk about when people ask me about gardening. I talk about winter gardening and extending the garden season, because people in my area have this, not everybody, but it's very common to have sort of a continental approach to gardening and to put your garden in on roughly the same schedule you might in Ontario or on the prairies or in a more continental part of North America. But we're way out on the coast with these long but not severe winters and long, relatively moderate temperature autumns and springs. And we have a very different seasonal setup than continental North America. And as such, we're able to grow like amazing winter vegetables. I'm planting my garden this year with the winter vegetables first, and I'm placing all the winter vegetables, and then I'm going to work my rotations from there. So I'm going to sort out like, okay, this bed's going to get these winter vegetables planted at this time. What can I grow in the spring before that? And also maybe what can I grow after that? But I'm putting the winter stuff in first, because I found over the years that those vegetables are higher value in almost every way for me than summer vegetables. Like, I find it pretty easy to have enough zucchini for quite a few months and enough cucumbers. And I don't really even need that much space to fulfill my zucchini and cucumber needs. But my winter vegetable needs are more space. I need more space and I need more time. But they're providing fresh, highly nutritious vegetables for, like in my climate, basically half the year, my harvests are what would be considered winter vegetables, like November, December, January, February, March, and then into April. Yeah, almost half the year, my harvests are of the group of vegetables that is considered winter vegetables. And then the summer vegetables start to get planted in the spring, March and April, and we eat them through, October or so. But so it's like where I am this far north, it's a 50-50 split. So I feel like in a lot of North America, if people focus on winter vegetables, they can get a much, much, much longer season. And they can get, like, even just, I don't think a lot about economics in vegetables because I'm not farming anymore and I'm just growing for myself. But a consideration from an economic perspective, too, Vegetables are more expensive and generally lower quality in the dead of winter, and they're cheaper and generally higher quality in summer. And if I can produce them at the time of year when they're more expensive and lower quality, I'm in a sense getting more bang for my buck, or more bang for my effort or use of garden space. So I'm like highly interested in that as a concept right now, and I like very much want to hear what other people's experiences have been. And that's sort of why I started using Twitter too, because I wanted to figure out a way to put up a bunch of pictures of what's possible in the wintertime in this climate. Mm-hmm. So on a whim, I started using Twitter in November to do that. And now I'm probably going to put other, I mean, I've been putting other pictures up now, but I really like that too. That was my first foray really into social media, and I found it to be super rewarding. But that was what propelled me to do that, is I wanted a way to show some images of that, the images of what is possible, because what is possible in winter here is so much broader than I ever expected. And like, to me, super hopeful.
So. Yeah. I think that's a good thing to think about to close on, is the idea that, you can do so much more than I think people realize with the garden. You can grow, like we're talking about, like seasonal stuff, but also the opposite is the case too, where you can do a lot of stuff with very little if you just set up the things in the right conditions.
Totally. It's very close to magic when it works well.
That is so true. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it basically is magic, right? It, to some extent, because I guess,
yeah.
Yeah. I feel like anytime something does work, I still to the point where anytime something comes out of the ground that I planted, I'm like, man, I can't believe it actually worked.
Yeah. I still feel that way too. After many, many years, very much have that feeling.
I think there's got to be something in our brains that does that. Maybe it's some sort of primitive thing.
Yeah, I think it's like old stuff that we can't escape. Like when people first get into vegetable gardens and they'll gaze upon a new bed of earth, you know, sprouting a row of something or growing something. And when it first starts to grow, like people have described that to me in ways that are very profound. Like people have described their feeling to witness that, like in ways that it's very transformative for some people in some situations, I think, and potentially very healing as well. And I think we, for the past however many thousands of years, not our whole evolution as a species, but for the past 10 or 20 or 30,000 years, I'm not totally sure, raising crops has been a big part of what we've been up to. And I think that doesn't go away with a couple of centuries of industrialization and modern society. I think it's sitting there waiting to germinate in people. Yeah,
totally.
I think about that a lot.
Even if you think about before people were growing things, cultivating things, if you're just hunting and gathering, if you're just gathering, you're looking out for stuff, and that's probably a big part of your brain there's some primitive part of your brain that sees certain things or smells certain things that tells it, like, okay, this is going to be good. This is a good thing.
Yes.
That we see this little shoot coming out, or like the color of green that this pine needle is means it's really soft, kind of just stuff like that. It seems
totally.
Like just never go away.
Never, not in thousands of years.
Yeah,
I think
can't.
A lot of that is patterns too, patterns and rhythms. I think we can see patterns. Like I pick a lot of wild mushrooms, and I'm not always totally sure which part of the visual system, for lack of a better word, I'm using to see where mushrooms are. Like I don't think it's what I used to think it was necessarily, that I see this one thing that is that. I think it has to do with patterns and rhythms across the landscape. And I think our brains are picking up like things occurring in certain sequences and in certain arrangements. And yeah, it's kind of hard to describe, but
no,
I think like
sense.
Rows of plants.
It's like you're kind of seeing something. It's that thing where, you know, those old magic eye things where you cross your eyes and something pops out.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're seeing something that's there in the composite and not something that's there at a macro level. It's like you're kind of taking a broad look at something, and that's how you kind of it's almost like you say, it feels like there's going to be some more over here, but really, you know, they are, because it's like This is there's a pattern that's established that you can't describe that is something that tells your brain like, oh, this is where they've been before in something like this. So I bet there'll be something like this over here again.
100%.
Yeah, that's super.
That comes up
shit.
Again and again. Totally. Very old stuff.
Wow. That's
and happening deep in our brains somewhere.
That's
I like
crazy.
That kind of thing. That's nice to think about.
It was great talking with you, Ryan. We covered so much cool
Likewise,
shit
Johnny.
Here,
what a delight to speak with you.
And what's so people can see your pictures and stuff. Your Twitter is it's RNASSICHUK, R Nasichuk on Twitter.
Yes. Yes, RNASSICHUK. And I can be emailed too if people would like. It's just my last name, NASSICHUK @gmail.
Cool.
And I'm for hire in a variety of ways.
Awesome.
So, folks are certainly welcome to reach out.
Great. Thanks for talking, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Johnny. This was an absolute delight, and I hope your spring garden grows beautifully.
You're getting a little too smart. You're trying to get ahead. You're playing with my heart. Between the lines of red, I got to cut you down and make you hang around. Woo! Some feeling, love's feeling.